I'm Bill Marv. I'm the president of the Church Music Association of America, a sponsoring organization for this colloquium. And it's my pleasant duty to welcome you to the colloquium and to tell you just a little bit about it, what we're going to do, and why we're going to do it, or why we've planned to do it. The week is divided into several portions, that is to say, a substantial amount of singing in a choir, singing polyphonic music essentially, plus a substantial amount of singing Gregorian chant, and then each day liturgical services, principally the Mass each day, plus in the morning prayer, and at night after the night's exercise, evening prayer. Actually, it's not Vespers, it's Compline at the night that we'll sing together. And then there will be lectures, discussions of topics that pertain to church music. But there is an interesting sort of problem in dealing with church music today. The question is, do you deal with the ideal or do you deal with the practical? And the ideal, I suppose one has to say, is the tradition of chant and polyphony. And in some sense, the ideal is the sung Mass, even the sung Mass in Latin. How many of us have that regularly in our parishes? There's one, two, three. I do two. But not all of us by any means. And so our decision has been a kind of twofold decision. One is, let's represent as best we can the ideal for you, that you might take this ideal back home with you. At the same time, let's address some of the practical issues that we have to face, and that's why we have two principal musical issues as parts of our lectures this time. One is the selection of hymns, and one is the performance of the responsorial song. So that those are things that actually pertain to the use of the vernacular in the Sunday liturgy and to its music. But on the other hand, many of you have expressed the desire and the interest to experience the tradition of church music as intensely as possible, so that also our liturgies will be mostly completely sung liturgies and more in Latin than in English. We will have as our first liturgy one entirely in English, and then after that mostly in Latin, though the morning prayer and the evening prayer will be in English. The reason for that is what I would call the relationship of the paradigm to gradualism. The paradigm. Let's go back a little bit about the paradigm. Let's think about the history of this organization, even. The Church Music Association of America was formed by an amalgamation of the Society of St. Cecilia and the Catholic Choir Masters Guild, as I understand it. And that was shortly after the Vatican Council. The Society of St. Cecilia was founded in, was it Milwaukee, in 1874. And it began to publish its journal, Cecilia. So we rather proudly claim that sacred music, which we still publish, which is a continuation of Cecilia, is in fact the oldest continuing music publication in the United States. So we have a tradition. This tradition comes from German Cecilianism. That is to say, the sense of the revival in the 19th century of the tradition of church music. And so that is our aim, the revival of church music. Not just the old music, all church music. And our aim is also the revival of church music in the context of the liturgy and in the context of the Roman Rite, as it was as it was specified by the Second Vatican Council. So at the Second Vatican Council, the first document was the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy. And the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy specified that Gregorian chant have pride of place in the Roman Rite. One doesn't see a lot of evidence of Gregorian chant having pride of place in the Roman Rite in this country. Excuse me. So, in fact, one of our campaigns is to see that we can increase the use of Gregorian chant for the regular services. And another thing that comes from the council is that polyphonic music, the tradition of classical polyphony, has a special role. So you can, in fact, think of the motets of Palestrina particularly. Thank you so much. That's just what I need. You can think of the motets of Palestrina and many others as also having a privileged place in the use of the church. Often it's been said, oh, you people are just wanting to make exclusive use of chant and polyphony. Fact is, I don't think any of us have ever said that. We want these things to have a priority, not necessarily to be exclusively used. So, still, I would say there is a paradigm. The paradigm is, first of all, the sung mass sung in Gregorian chant with ordinary, that is to say, Kyrie, Gloria, Credo, Sanctus, Agnus Dei, those parts that are constant from day to day, and proper introit, gradual, Alleluia, or tract, offertory communion, those parts which change each day, all of that sung in Gregorian chant with the priest celebrant singing his part. I would say that's the principal and fundamental paradigm. When I was asked to take over a choir that I had once directed before, it had come to be a choir and congregation singing chant with a priest saying a low mass at the altar, speaking the entire mass. And they asked me, would you conduct this choir again? And I said, no. This liturgy isn't working. If the priest speaks his whole parts and then the choir and congregation go along singing chant, there's a disproportion there. And I don't think I can make that work. Much to my surprise, they said, all right, you tell us what you want. I said, that's very simple. Sing everything. Have the priest sing all his parts. And they said, all right, make up an order of service and spell out exactly how it would be done, which I did. And I also wrote a short rationale for why it should be done that way. That was in 1972. 73. The rationale was published in Sacred Music, in fact. And then they looked it all over and they had a couple of things they didn't like, and so they said, let's discuss this, and we made some adjustments. And we proceeded, then I took it over, we proceeded to have a real sung mass. Everything sung by the priest except for the sermon, of course. I didn't dare ask for the same details. But I would say that that is, in some ways, a paradigm. Now, the interesting thing is, you'll be perhaps surprised at this, all of the priest's parts are in English. It's not an entirely Latin mass. That's a different kind of paradigm. And that is also a paradigm, and one that we keep on some days. So we do have, on occasion, a Latin mass completely, except for the lessons. But even the lessons are sung. And if I had time, I'd tell you some nice stories about why you should sing the lessons, but that will remain for another time. What I'm getting at is that this is a paradigm. Another part of the paradigm is the use of polyphonic music. So that, there are two ways in which that works. One is that to this Gregorian Mass, and by the way, it's a Mass in which the congregation sings all of the ordinary, Kyrie, Gloria, Credo, Sanctus, Agnus, in Gregorian chant, and they sing about six different chant ordinaries in the course of the year. I think myself that that's feasible to be done in any well-educated parish with some good work. It takes a long time to achieve it. I wouldn't deny that. But I think it's quite achievable, and I have to say that I think our congregation is much more transient, because it's a university congregation, than some, so that it would be easier to manage in some other circumstances. But the point is only, the congregation has a substantial role in singing. And it's not just singing little ditties, it's singing substantial music, all of the Gregorian ordinaries. The addition can be a Renaissance motet at communion, even at the offertory if there's time. And if you incense the altar at the offertory, then there's time for a Renaissance motet. So you see, even the choir director can have an influence on the liturgy by demanding that the altar be incensed. Yet another part of the paradigm is the greater part of the tradition of polyphonic music is the Mass ordinary. A polyphonic ordinary, then, can also be sung. There are those who would object to having sung ordinary, a polyphonic ordinary, because it excludes the congregation from at least vocal participation. In my circumstance, what we do is to sing a polyphonic ordinary on the major feast days, about 10 or 12 days of the year, while the congregation sings the ordinary the rest of the Sundays. What that means is the congregation is hearing a sophisticated and beautiful setting of the texts, which they are very familiar with because they ordinarily sing them. I have never heard an objection to... I have heard one objection once. I remember one. But rarely do I hear any objection to this. The congregation has its place. And the congregation still sings all the responses, the Lord's Prayer. I have resisted, in fact, adding a hymn to that. The hymn seems on a lower level than the polyphonic ordinary. And unless I heard some real demand for it, I would simply not worry about it. Still, that's the paradigm. You see, but you then ask, how do you get there from here? I would be the last person to say that you could all of a sudden... Suppose somebody came along with some money and said, look here, I'll donate this amount of money a year if you will produce a sung high mass. Would you then, the next Sunday, impose just what I described on an unsuspecting congregation? Hardly. You have to educate them before they know what they'll have. And I have to look back at my own personal experience in 1964 when the language was changed. And all of a sudden, the next Sunday, we were told, you will sing four hymns. And I watched Catholic congregations sit on their hands and not sing the hymns because they didn't understand why they were supposed to. So you have to then say, you have to educate them, you have to introduce things gradually. And this is what I would call the principle of gradualism. I think it's the only way to achieve a really good music program with chant and polyphony. And there are many things that you can introduce piece by piece. For instance, and I'll talk later this week about the communion antiphone. But the communion antiphone is the ideal piece of the Mass proper to introduce first, because you have plenty of time at communion. If it's expected, there's time to sing a hymn as well as to sing the communion antiphone. Doesn't take up anybody else's time particularly. Another thing you can introduce early on is the singing of the Psalms. I think many people would be quite relieved to have the simple Sanctus, Sanctus, replace Marty Hogan's rather tired piece by now. I heard that piece twice. I hardly ever get to hear anybody's liturgy, but I heard two liturgies twice this in the last couple of months. Both of them used Marty Hogan's Sanctus. And I learned something really important, and that is, it depends on how you accompany them. They sound quite different. Both times they were accompanied by the organ. I've heard them often before accompanied by guitars or piano, drums, flutes, percussion, string bass, whatever. To have it accompanied by the organ takes it into some kind of a sacred realm, and it changes the sound of the piece substantially. The one proviso, though, one of the times they played a trumpet descant, probably paid the trumpeter well. They played a trumpet descant. It turned it into movie music. It sounded just like the score from Cecil B. DeMille's Ten Commandments. So, other things you can add. You can add things one at a time. I would say, aim for the real Gregorian propers, not substitutes. Even if you have to follow the principle which the council permitted of using a seasonal proper, using the same introit three or four Sundays in a row, and then another one. That's not ideal. That's gradualism. When your choir is familiar with them, then add more. The next year around, do it only every two Sundays. The next year around, they'll say, oh, we know those pieces. And you'll be able to do all of them. So be creative. And that's the reason that we want you to see the paradigm. We want you to see what a real sung Mass is like, so that you'll have something to keep in mind as you aim for introducing what you're going to do there. Now, some other things to say about what we're doing. This year, for the first time, we will have one of the Masses in the old rite. That is to say, what's sometimes called the Tridentine rite. Tridentine from the Council of Trent. Oddly enough, Tridentine is the adjective that that comes from the word the city of Trent, which is the location of the council, which was held after the Reformation. That missal stood from the end of the 16th century until 1969. And there are values that are embodied in that liturgy. Our principal reason for having a Tridentine Mass is so that you can witness it and experience it and come ultimately to understand some of the values which it represents. For example, the Tridentine Rite differs from the New Rite in a number of features. One is that it's a much more fixed order of service. There aren't very many options. And that there's a virtue to that. No liturgy committees, no options to argue about. It's all there for you to do. The Tridentine Mass ordinarily is celebrated facing the altar. The news media will tell you the priest celebrates Mass with his back to the people. That's not quite enough. He's not turning his back to the people. He's facing God. And the symbolism is one of orientation. The churches traditionally faced east because the rising sun was a symbol of the rising Christ. And the east was the direction to which Christ was thought to have ascended and would return. So facing east is an eschatological action. You are expecting the return of Christ. Even graves used to be oriented so that you were buried with your feet facing east so that when he came again, you could stand up and see him. I visited my hometown in eastern Washington, a little farming town, and visited the cemeteries there. There were two different cemeteries. I was astonished to see that both of these cemeteries, every last grave faced east. I don't know whether that was an accident, I doubt it was, or whether it was a persistent tradition that you buried bodies facing east so they could rise facing Christ. It's a compelling symbol to address prayer to the east, upward, to have the priest and the people facing the same direction. When the priest faces the people, there is a danger that the priest will be tempted to try to work the crowd. And the result of that will sometimes be a two-way conversation between the priest and the congregation, and God is up there waiting them to address him again. So there is something to be learned then from the Tridentine Rite. And I think that a study of that rite is valuable. We await, in fact, a motu proprio from Pope Benedict XVI. It's now said that it's already signed and will be coming, and it will give further access to the Tridentine Mass. And I encourage you to take advantage of the possibility of learning from the tradition what values it represents. But that's why we're having that Mass. Now, another thing to say is that there is in the tradition a number of significant documents that give us guidance in the choice and in the performance of liturgical music. And this goes back particularly to the Second Vatican Council. The Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy specifies right at the beginning that the regulation of the liturgy belongs principally to the Roman pontiff. That means that the Roman usage is also a paradigm. And that even the tradition of liturgical legislation, which is Roman, pertains and is still valid. Even after the Reformation of the Rite, even after the introduction of the new rites, And even after the revision of the Code of Canon Law, the Code of Canon Law specifies at the very beginning that this Code of Canon Law will not address most liturgical issues because these are the province of the Roman Pontiff. All of that is to say, the Roman documents are definitive concerning the liturgy. And we have important, significant Roman documents. I'll mention just a few. 19.3, St. Pius X, motu proprio, the document which initiated or which validated the restoration of Gregorian chant to the liturgy. Pope Pius XII, two significant documents on music and the liturgy, Musica Sacrae Ministerium and De Musica Sacra. The Second Vatican Council itself, the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy. 1967, the second instruction on the implementation of the Council, the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy, specifically Musicam Sacram, an extensive document on the use of music following the Council. This document remains liturgical law and is something that is worth a considerable amount of attention. What those documents say are many, many things, but among the most important, Gregorian chant has pride of place in the Roman Rite. Polyphonic music has a special privileged role. The pipe organ is the liturgical instrument. Other instruments may be admitted, but the pipe organ has priority. And it says organum tubulatum. It doesn't say organ electronicum or organum digitalum. Finally, another principle that comes from Musicam Sacrum in 1967 is also important. That is, the tradition in the Tridentine Rite was you had low masses and high masses. A low mass is a spoken mass, essentially no sung music that's integral to the liturgy. High mass is a completely sung mass. And in the old days, you either had a high mass or you had a low mass. And there's a value in having the ideal of the high mass, because these days what we have mostly is what I would call the middle mass. It's half sung and half spoken, and you never know quite what it's going to be. You could also call it the potpourri mass. Everything under the sun, and things don't hang together so well. So there was a value to that. Musicam Sacram says the distinction between the high mass and the low mass is to be maintained. In other words, there is still such a thing as a high mass, a completely sung mass. There is such a thing as a completely spoken mass. Nevertheless, in order to achieve the incorporation of music in the liturgy, it also allows for degrees of implementation of music. And it specifies 3 degrees of implementation of music. 1 amounts essentially to the celebrant singing his parts, plus the congregation singing the Sanctus, which is the conclusion of the celebrant's part, the preface. The second stage is the ordinary of the Mass, essentially the rest of the ordinary of the Mass. And the third stage is then the propers of the Mass. I think that's worth thinking about a lot. First of all, because until the priest sings his parts, the music isn't quite integrated into the liturgy. And I'm delighted to see that there are, in fact, 17 priests at our colloquium this year. Many more than last year, in fact. And we have a little course from Father Scaris on the singing of the priest's parts in the Mass. Because we're all agreed, I think, that the integration of the liturgy musically takes place when the priest sings his parts. I have to say even that, and this is an ideal that I was hesitant to ask for, but I finally did, and that is if the lessons are sung. Many clergy really are quite allergic to the idea of singing the epistle and the gospel and the Old Testament lesson, because perhaps they feel that they can more persuasively deliver the text in a spoken way. Still, we had an experiment. So we did this. We sang the lessons always. And the lessons can be sung each to its proper tone. So they're quite beautifully done. We got a new pastor. And he said, I like many things you're doing, but there's some things I don't like. I don't like singing the lessons. This isn't opera. And so I meekly said, well, would you like to know why we're doing it? Well, that caught him completely off guard. But he said, all right, but make it short. Those were his very words. And so I tried to explain it, and then he said, all right, let's do an experiment. Let's have you not sing the lessons for 3 months. And if after that time you think it's better to sing them, then we'll reconsider it. We came away from that meeting with quite disparate views of what was going to happen. He thought that once the lessons were spoken, we'd all be convinced that it was much better to speak them. I thought, we'll only have to wait for 3 months. So after 3 months, I have to admit, we learned something. What we learned was, when you sing the lessons, there's a continuity between the Old Testament, then the gradual, then the New Testament, then the Alleluia, and then the Gospel. And there's a crescendo, and the Gospel comes as the culmination of this. And when the Gospel is sung, it is really the culmination. When it's spoken, it's a bit of a letdown. Moreover, when the lessons are spoken, the gradual and the Alleluia seem just a little out of place. They seem just a little too long. And yet when the lessons are sung, they don't. The interesting thing, though, was the reaction of the congregation. I had no idea what they would say. I thought they wouldn't say anything. They were upset. The first Sunday, we didn't say anything. The lessons weren't sung. They came up after Mass and said, where are our sung lessons? Why are we not having the sung lessons? And then they told me why the sung lesson was better. You can hear the text better, and you're getting the text presented as the scripture rather than as one man's or another man's version of it. And it's maybe better to get it straight than to have it mediated by the idiosyncratic delivery of an individual. So those three levels then are important, and they can be the means for the gradualism. They can be the means of introducing things one at a time. And if you can persuade your clergy to sing their parts, you're well on the way, I think, to getting a very good development of the paradigm. There was a question.
Professor, is there an issue if you do single essence of clerical verse that needs to be addressed at graduate level or not?
I don't think it's an issue of clerical orders. It is an issue of clerical competence. If they can't do it, then they don't.
No, but I just want to make sure.
No. In either case, the gospel has to be sung by a deacon or above, and the others can be sung by anybody.
Okay.
Yeah. But then, those three levels. But there is a more fundamental issue yet. And I think this is even more at the basis of what we're doing here. It is the issue of what is the value of music and the liturgy. And it goes back to what, when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, what Benedict said. Utility music is insufficient. Utility music, music that simply sets the text in one way or another. Utility music is useless. The reason for that is that music is there to make the liturgy more beautiful. It's as simple as that. If you look at the setting of a text to music. This is an exercise that I can give students in discussing any setting of a text. You give them the text and you give an explication of the text. You penetrate the meaning of the text and its form. And then you ask the student to imagine now what the musical setting will be like of that text. Say a Schubert song, even. And then they imagine what a Schubert song will sound like. And students with good acquaintance with that music can do that well. They can come up with a fairly vivid imagination. And then you play the song, and it's all different. It doesn't sound anything like what they imagined. Because Schubert can do it better than they can. And because, moreover, any setting of a text will realize something inherent in the text and will also add something that cannot have been anticipated. And that's part of the beauty of a musical setting of a text, that it adds something more. Take, for example, a simple antiphon. Justus sut palma florebit, sicut cedrus libani multiplicabitur. It goes like this.
Justus sut palma florebit, sicut cedrus libani multiplicabitur.
Justus sut palma florebit, sicut cedrus libani multiplicabitur. The just man shall flourish like a palm tree, like a cedar of Lebanon, he shall be multiplied. The structure of the text is two parallel statements. They say essentially the same thing in other words. A nice parallelism that's characteristic of psalm verses. And in fact, the melody makes use of the text accent.
Justus ut palma.
So the accented syllables get more motion. And so there's something of the rhetoric of the text involved in the setting of the melody. And yet, there's an element of harmony also that is not to be anticipated from the text. It starts on D, but then makes a C, E, G triad. Then it makes a kind of an F triad. And then it returns to D. So most of the piece is around C and F, even though it begins and ends on D. So there's a sense of progression of idea and of tonality within the piece itself that means that there is an element of intrinsic beauty added to the melody, to the text. You can see that in practically any Gregorian piece, in practically any piece of polyphony, in practically any piece of excellent music. And so the role of music then in the liturgy is to add the element of beauty to what is intrinsic to the liturgy, its texts. And when one thinks about the Gregorian chants for the liturgy, you can go back to St. Pius X and his motu proprio, and you can read what he says are the characteristics of sacred music, characteristics of chant. It's sacred, it's beautiful, it's universal. That's how it's usually translated. But in fact, for beautiful, the words are bontà delle forme, or bonitas formarum in the Latin. Notice that that is excellence or goodness of forms in the plural. Bonitas formarum, excellence of forms. What are the forms? The forms are the very different genres of music that are represented by introit, offertory, communion, gradual, alleluia, Kyrie, Gloria, chant for the lessons, chant for the prayers. All of those parts have distinctive Gregorian forms. And just like the colors of the vestments, intuitively they say what this form is. You walk into a mass and you see red vestments and you say, aha, this is no ordinary Sunday. This has got to be the Feast of a Martyr unless it's Pentecost or Palm Sunday or Good Friday. Those colors say something to you immediately without your having to reason about them. Likewise, the style of chant says something about it. If you come in the middle of the Mass and they're singing a lesson that ends like this, then you know it's not the Gospel, but the Old Testament. And likewise, every part of the chanted liturgy is differentiated that way. That makes it extraordinarily beautiful, because there's a proportion of style to function. And so the beauty of the liturgy, then, should be our principal concern. And when we talk about liturgical music, when we make judgments about liturgical music, the first judgment should be, but is it beautiful? Does it make the liturgy beautiful? So, and the reason it should be beautiful is because beauty is a transcendental. Beauty is one of those things that is possessed by all beings, but is possessed in the highest order by God. And as a result, beautiful things can lead to God. And so when the liturgy is made beautiful, we are aided to being led to God by the liturgy. And so that's why we should come to colloquia like this one and think and talk and worry about the fact that the music of the liturgy should be beautiful. And I hope by the end of the week you will have even a better idea of how the music at the liturgy, how the liturgy itself can be made more beautiful by music. Have a wonderful, prosperous, fully enjoyable, but also spiritual time this week, and I'll be there with you, enjoying, benefiting, learning as well.